and can only be realized in the final analysis through its vanguard party and its leadership. As also pointed out in our party's draft program, in playing its vanguard role in leading the masses to make revolution and to remake society, the way the party does this is by applying what we call the mass line. This is an understanding that Mao Zedong developed in the course of the Chinese Revolution, drawing from the experience of previous revolutions. The mass line means basically that you go out among the masses and learn what's on their minds, their thoughts, their insights, their understanding, the way they see the world.
And how many millions of people were killed by Mao?
You bring back those ideas. You recognize by scientifically looking at it that some of them are correct and some of them are not so correct. But you work to concentrate, to strengthen, to build up what is correct in the understanding of the masses. And on that basis, to develop lines and policies to go back to the masses with, to propagate, to carry out these lines, to popularize them among the masses, and to work with the masses to take up these lines and policies and to carry them out, and then to carry forward the struggle together with the masses, to persevere together with them as Mao.
Now, this is his idea of how it's supposed to work. Now, when you listen to him describing the social conditions in many countries, the sexist conditions, the poverty conditions, the health conditions, the soldier, the army conditions, et cetera, you can't help but agree with him. But here, when he's talking, he's basically doing a Mao thing. I mean, he's basically saying that there is one correct idea, and we need to steer everybody into that one idea. It's a top-down revolution. We need charismatic leaders. That's the problem that I have with any kind of revolutionary foment. It's not about leaders. In fact, a leader is a bad thing. We don't need leaders. We need cells. We need to move from the bottom up. We need grassroots organization within the local community is a good place to start, because that affects you directly in your own way. What Kill Radio is doing is grassroots. You people listening, bless your hearts for being there. You're part of a revolution just by being here. You know, I have to. I'm sorry if I seem to be cynical or negative to this, but it strikes me that it's going in the wrong way. Bob Avakian, we're listening to Bob Avakian explain how revolution could take place, and this is the Kill Radio Thursday Impressionistic News Hour for March 24th, 2005, and it's 6:32 p.m.
I said to bring these policies into action. Let's take an example of what this means. You're out working among the masses and someone says, the people who run this country, Bush and the rest of them, are just a bunch of big-time criminals and mass murderers. So far, so good. But then they add, but they're going to get theirs. They're going to be punished in the end. God will take care of that. Well, here you have to divide things into two, as we say. You have to distinguish. You have to pick out what is correct in what they're saying and unite with it. And as I said, develop lines and policies that unite with that and take that back to people in a higher form that they can take up and build struggle around. You have to develop programs and policies and means of struggle that unite with what is advanced and correct in people's understanding and that will enable them to act to move things forward while continuing to carry out struggle over what they do not yet understand correctly or fully. Again, what's involved here is a process of unity. Struggle, unity. Now, another important point is that within the broader united front that must be built for revolution in the U.S., there is a key and strategic alliance, what we call a solid core of the united front that must be built. This solid core is the alliance between the struggle of the proletariat of all nationalities to end all exploitation.
You say the world is mad.
Uniting with the...
You say that you've been had. You don't like your part in the flow show. You say it's all a bust. There's no one you can trust. Well, now tell me something that I don't know. You say the world's a mess, and it's anybody's guess as to who will deliver that next low blow. You suffer from the strain, and you don't take pain. Well, tell me something that I don't know. You never got your big break, and you don't see the magic in the moon glow. You're on a one-way street, and your life is incomplete. Well, tell me something that I don't know. You're uptight, it ain't right.
See how art can actually say things more clearly. That was Van Morrison from the from a tribute to Mos Allison, Tell Me Something That I Don't Know. And I certainly hope Joe Veal will be on next week, and or soon anyway, and we can actually have a discussion about it. Obviously, I'm not into it that much. If I were 21, maybe I'd listen. Anyway, I want to play now at least portions of an interview with Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine and other things. And this is from a PBS program called Speaking Freely. It's not the best sound quality. I taped it off the air, but here's Tom Morello, and here we go.
Welcome to Speaking Freely, a weekly conversation about free expression in America. I'm Ken Paulson. Today we're joined by a founding member of Rage Against the Machine and now Audio Slave, a man who has used his music to help build awareness, Tom Morello. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now that was yet another identity. You've been a member of two terrific bands, yep. and yet if people see you on this current tour, they are introduced to you as the Night Watchman.
Yeah, well, the Night Watchman is my political folk persona that endeavors to be the Black Woody Guthrie, at least settle for Tom Joad.
Well, that's pretty good aspiration. If you accomplish being the Black Woody Guthrie,
that's something. Well, you know, I figure you raise the bar high.
That is. You know, it's remarkable the success of Rage Against the Machine because it is an overtly rock and roll and political rock and roll band. I mean, it is hard rock, but it's also hard sentiments.
Yeah.
And you look at the history of rock and roll, there are very few examples of that. You've got, you know, Chuck D and Public Enemy, you've got The Clash.
Yeah.
But those are few and far between. Why is that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it begins with, at any given time, there are probably a lot of bands who express political sentiments through their music. They don't always reach the top of the Billboard charts, however. I think that the bands that you cited, Public Enemy and The Clash, had something in common with Rage Against the Machine. That was they had a great musical chemistry to begin with, and that's a potent way to deliver whatever message you put on top of it, whether it's love songs, whether it's political songs. I think it has to start with playing great music.
And Rage Against the Machine played a lot of events where there were, I mean, it was a heavy metal lineup.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of those Ozfest places, Ozfest events, were not always compatible with your political beliefs. I think you've talked about seeing skinheads and people who have a sort of a white supremacy agenda at those. And what is it about hard rock that would foster that kind of mentality?
Well, I think that hard rock fosters different mentalities, and one of the reasons why I think bands like Rage Against the Machine and System of a Down, other bands like that, are important, is that, you know, this is my music too, And actually, the year when I saw some of the skinhead people at the Ozfest was a year when on the main stage every band had a multi-ethnic lineup. You know, and the face of hard rock music has changed dramatically, and it's become much more. You know, there are more hues in the hard rock rainbow than there once were. So I think it's important to have that kind of diversity of opinions expressed on the stage, expressed on the concourse that you see, you know, expressed in the music, that reflects an audience of diverse opinions.
And to be clear, we don't want to stereotype hard rock or heavy metal fans.
Yeah.
They are as diverse as the population.
Yeah.
But typically at singer-songwriter events with people raising matches, they're not skinheads.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why bands that play harder rock music that contain a political message, I think, are that much more important. With Rage Against the Machine, we really cast the nets wide, and there are many people who were drawn to the music because of the music, and then later were listening to the lyrics and found they were very different from the lyrics in the rest of their record collection. I mean, I see every day, you know, walking out of the studio today, there'll be two or three kids that'll come up to me and say, you know, thank you for turning me on to this issue, that issue, or helping me to look beyond your songs to see what I think about what's going on in my workplace, my community, my country, and in the world.
Now, Audioslave is a brand new band with some common elements, but not as overtly political.
Yeah.
Will that change, do you think, in time?
Well, I mean, I think that, like we were talking about earlier, I think that the first step for any band to be compelling is it has to be artistically compelling, and how that happens is it develops organically. Rage Against the Machine and Soundgarden developed unique styles of music because they just happened. The chemistry of the individual musicians blossomed into that. It was exactly the same with Audioslave. We had no preconceived notions. We didn't try to shoehorn the new band into the old shoes. We just let it happen naturally. And I think that's why it was so satisfying for us to play, and so and why people gravitated towards it as well. For me, there was because I still have my political opinions like I always have, and it's been important to me via the thing I do for a living, music, to get them out, to find a way to do that. And that's when Serge Tankian and myself formed Axis of Justice, which is an exclusively political organization, nonprofit political organization, to do the grassroots organizing while Audioslave was no longer singing about it, the band was very supportive of this real life political entity.
Well, we do want to talk about Axis of Justice, but I'm curious about something. You're almost a feature writer's fantasy performer in that you can write about your background, and it's like, what an amazing story. This is a gentleman whose parents both stood up for individual liberties. You were raised in a home clearly with respect and for civil rights and equality. You go to Harvard, you get a terrific education, and you join a rock and roll band. You know,
there's the typical A to B to C that lends you in this chair.
There's a made for TV movie in there somewhere. Can you talk a little bit about your parents, though, and their early commitment and how that affected you?
Sure. Well, I didn't grow up with my dad, but my mom and dad met in Kenya, where my father was part of the independence struggle, the Mau Mau independence struggle against the British. They were married there, but I was born in New York City. They were divorced. He moved back to Kenya. He was part of Kenya's first United Nations delegation. He moved back to Kenya, and she moved back to the small town in Illinois where she grew up, and that's where I grew up as well. I had Dad's picture around the house and pictures of Jomo Kenyatta and and Kwame Nkrumah and people like that around the house. It was really sort of the political upbringing I got in my own household, which I thought was very natural until I got out into to the world at large or into school and discovered there were the prevalent opinions were very different than the ones discussed in my house. People sometimes ask, how did you become a political person? And I think that the first answer is the one that's maybe too obvious is I grew up black in America. I grew up in, I integrated Libertyville, Illinois. I was the first person of color to live in Libertyville. And this was in 1965, my mother, who was looking for public high school teaching jobs, the schools would say, you're a great teacher, you're very qualified, we'd love to have you teach here, but you're an interracial family. She had a one-year-old, brown-skinned child, and so you have to live, in the ghetto two towns over, right? Libertyville was the first, appropriately titled town, was the first community that would allow her to live there, allow her to work there and us to live there in peace. Still then, they had to go door-to-door, and asked the real estate agent had to ask the people in the apartment building if it was cool, and I think that I got by on my Kenyan credentials more than anything else. So I think that's a very politicizing thing. When you step out onto that playground, there's issues came up for me which might not for if I'd grown up in an entirely black neighborhood or white neighborhood. And then when I went to high school and I was blessed with having a circle of friends who were thinkers and were willing to sort of challenge what we saw around us. was involved in numbers from underground school newspapers to picking up a guitar and discovering bands like The Clash and rock and roll music, and how that could be sort of an ice pick, you know, to swing against the establishment.
Rage Against the Machine has had critics because you take stands, but I think the most surprising censorship, if you will, of Rage Against the Machine came at the hands of Clear Channel. Yeah. After the tragic events of September 11th, what we had was an account from the company. We'll just give them the benefit of the doubt here. A group of employees deciding nationwide that they really ought to spread the word about some music that should no longer be played on Clear Channel. Now, Clear Channel is a media giant. They own more radio stations than anybody. They control
over 1,000 stations.
They control everything, concerts, you name it. Yeah. And all over this company came this list of more than 100 songs that said, you know, we really shouldn't play these songs after September 11th. What was unique, as I understand it, about Rage Against the Machine is they pretty much banned all of your music.
They didn't pretty much ban all of our music. It was the one artist that was singled out. The entire catalog was singled out for censorship. And just to give you an idea of how ridiculous it was, some of the songs on the list included John Lennon's Imagine, The Bangles' Walk Like an Egyptian, and the Gap Band's You Dropped a Bomb on Me. So that's they were throwing the darts were being thrown in the dark, you know, against us.
So what was your reaction when you hear that basically Rage Against the Machine is public enemy number one in the eyes of a Clear Channel?
Well, I mean, there was a small bit of pride, but I think, it could be misconstrued. You know, there was certainly nothing in the Rage Against the Machine canon that was supportive of the terrorist events that happened. I think it gave someone the opportunity in the upper echelons of Clear Channel who didn't like the band's politics to do what they've been longing to do for a while, and that's just completely ban them from the radio. It's interesting, when we got a hold of the list, we were aghast, and our attorney called them up and said, you know, there's this list, and they said, there's no such list. So we faxed it to them. And they went, Oh, that list. stammered excuses after that. But I think that what it highlights is not that, specifically Clear Channel is this evil perpetrator of censorship, which they may or may not be on a daily basis, but it highlights the issue of media consolidation and how dangerous it is to the First Amendment, how dangerous it is to democracy. Because the Tell Us the Truth tour, which we're on now, is highlighting that and how media consolidation basically means that a few massive corporations will control all of what you see and hear on TV, radio, and print. And that severely narrows the number of gatekeepers who control political discourse and the arts. And that can mean like a band who has controversial opinions, despite the fact they've sold 15 million records and have fans in all of these markets, immediately overnight disappears from the radio because of the ideas contained in their songs. That's something that's very dangerous.
And you see that even when it didn't involve the songs, the Dixie Chicks disappeared from
right.
Cumulus Broadcasting
right.
for a month entirely,
right. Right.
not because of their music.
Right, right.
Is that something that a generation can turn around? I mean, it's intriguing to me that young people who are so fluent in technology and can turn to the internet mm-hmm. for ideas, wouldn't you think that would be the antidote for media consolidation, that in fact, just at your computer, there's this world of different voices?
Right, right. Well, it certainly can. I mean, there are a lot of people who can't afford computers, though. And one thing that I don't think that people realize clearly, which is that the airwaves belong to the public. Television, radio, et cetera, belong to you and me. And they should reflect us in the opinions. And we're finding with this, 10 years ago, there were as few as 50 corporations that controlled most of the major media outlets in the country. Today, it's 6. And you would expect, if any group, any narrow group controlled, say, all the television countries in the state, whether it was casinos that owned them, or sports teams, or churches, that there'd be a bias. Well, we should expect the same sort of bias that major corporations own these.
Okay,
own these
I have to fade us out now. I enjoyed
now,
this interview very much. That's Tom Morello from Audio Slave talking with Ken Paulson on the now not on the air PBS show Speaking Freely. I present him as an alternative to the Bob Avakian stuff because he talks just more commonly about the way things are with people and about what you're trying to do, and he doesn't talk about a violent need for revolution. He understands the change is needed, but he also understands that you don't force the change on people because that won't work. You can't tell people that they can't make money, for instance. I mean, I love Henry Rollins because he'll say, well, you know, you should only be able to make $100,000 a year, that kind of utopian idealism. Well, Tom Morello is a smart man, and who knows, maybe we'll play more of that later. This is from the new album Revolved. This is a bootleg or pirate album by Chris Shaw and CCC. And this is a mashup album, taking the Beatles Revolver and mashing it with a bunch of other things. This is the Beatles versus the Birds versus the Who versus D-Light. And this is called Sunshine A Go-Go.
Go the day, sunshine.
First, I want to talk a little bit about the Schiavo case. I know you're probably sick to death of it. It's another great example of the extreme polarization that is present in our society today. A couple of days ago, I guess Monday or Tuesday, I was listening to Randy Rhodes on the Air America station. And, of course, she has the true... Christian viewpoint, which is that this is about a right to death, not about a right to life. So she was reading the history of all the court cases that have gone over this. You don't hear that in other places. She read the entire history of every court judgment and every situation. Back in 2001 or 2002, they took that tube in and out several times trying to handle this. And anyway, I'm listening to her very compassionate viewpoint, so I decide to listen to something else. So I flip over to KABC, and I hear Larry Elder, who I despise. And Larry Elder, of course, is outraged about the Congress intervening in the Schiavo case. But then Larry Elder doesn't think that the government should do anything, I guess, except line the pockets of business people, because he doesn't think that the government should have anything to do with education. He doesn't think that the government should be in the business of helping poor people. He doesn't think that the government should do anything. Of course, he's also like against he's for the legalization of all, you know, substances, drugs, because libertarians are opposed to the government doing anything. But then the first phone call he took, the fellow who called just vilified Michael Schiavo. Just vilified him. Just said he's a bigamist. He should be in jail for being married to two different women. And what a horrible person he is, and how dare the courts let him make any decisions at all. And I listened a little bit later to Al Rantel's show. Now, Al Rantel is another insane human being. He's a gay Republican. So he supports people who would literally kill him for what he does in the privacy of his own home. And not everybody's like that in the Republicans. I know Schwarzenegger, because he's been a movie actor, has been around gay people all the time. I mean, he's more liberal in that regard. But in fact, Al Rantel supports the whole Republican campaign, and he was taking phone calls. Everybody who called was vilifying Michael Schiavo, calling him a bastard, calling him the worst things you could possibly do, and saying that it's morally wrong to kill Terry, period. Okay. Well, you know, obviously, I'm sure most of you side with me to think that the best thing to do, the most humane thing to do, the most quote-unquote Christian thing to do would be to let Terry Schiavo pass away. She feels nothing. She doesn't feel thirst. When you hear idiots like Tom DeLay get up, she's to say, she's going to die of thirst. Well, she doesn't feel it. I mean, at least that's, I mean, not that I'm there. This is the evidence of every doctor who's ever examined her, except that one who was sent over from the Republicans in order to say something different. Tom DeLay actually referred to Terry Schiavo as being lucid. She's not lucid. So the Republicans are pandering, which is a terrible agenda, and makes them pretty much the lowest scum on this totem pole. The parents, I sympathize with the parents, so I can't blame them for pleading, you know, let my daughter live, but they're being completely myopic. The son, the brother of Terry Schiavo, I don't like him because he obviously doesn't care about his sister either. Now, in this vilification of Michael Schiavo, one thing that I don't think has been said, I don't know, do you know this? He's a male nurse. That's how he makes his living. So he knows how to treat people in infirm conditions. That's his job. For people to say, what does he have? What right does he have to say anything? Well, you know, the Republicans, of course, you know, here they are. They say that marriage is the highest act, and, you know, gay marriage just damages the whole institution of marriage, yada yada. But here they want to get in. They want to get into the marriage vows here, and say that the husband has no right to say things. How do we know that Terry Schiavo really said this? Well, again, he's a male nurse. He's involved with the health situation all the time. Of course the two of them had the opportunity to speak. It's too bad it's not in writing. You know, there are thousands of people every day, who are in this situation. And why they jump on this? Well, maybe because they have a 4-year-old video clip where it looks like she's smiling. Though if you watch that video clip, which is only about 10 seconds long or something, you see that her eyes are wandering around flatly. She's not looking at anything, you know. It's pathetic what they're doing to this poor woman. And the only good thing is, of course, that she's not physically suffering, because she can't. There's nothing there to suffer. He's vilified for saying, my wife died 15 years ago. Now, recall that they went around for years. He went around to try to find some kind of therapy, some kind of experimental medical procedures that could possibly, restart her brain functions. Everything failed. Every doctor, except that one, has said that she's in this state for good. And every court decision has been in the favor of the husband, and etc. Hopefully, she will pass away in the next day or so before this gets any worse. Though they keep saying it's going to take 2 weeks for her to die. Let her die. You all agree with me. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But let her die. All right. This is Bennett's opinion on the Kill Radio News. Hey, yeah, a cleaner version of Experiment in Terror by Henry Mancini than you're used to hearing me play. So that's it for the Impressionistic News for March 24th, 2005. I really don't know what to say to add to all this. The polarization, when I say polarization, it isn't quite polarized because the majority of people in all polls, 80% or something, say that Terry should be allowed to die. It's this hardcore Christian fundamentalist group and the rapture right Republicans who are the panderers who are turning her into this horrible example and feeding into just horrible things. I don't know. I can't say anymore. Anyway, you've been listening to Bennett's Impressionistic News Hour, and I should be back next Thursday, and maybe I will have Joe Veal in, and maybe he can say something counter to my rather cynical take on Revolutionary Communist Party, the Maoists. In the meantime, listen to my music show, The Chill Room, on Saturday nights here at midnight Pacific Standard Time. And this is Kill Radio. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to kill your friends.